Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Chris Lackey, author of Greasy Bend, the latest in the police procedural series featuring Hannah Bond and Bill Maytubby. We'll also hear from Agnes Gomillion, author of the dystopian novel The Record Keeper. Chris Lackey is a professor emeritus of English at the University of New Orleans. He's the author of short fiction, essays, and articles, and the book Road Frames, the American Highway Narrative. Now he's turned to writing fiction in the Bill Maytubby and Hannah Bond mystery series, which began with Nails Crossing and continues with Greasy Bend. He's speaking to us today from his home in Norman, Oklahoma. Chris Lackey, welcome.
Oh, thanks. It's good to be here.
So tell us about the corner of the world where Bill Maytubby and Hannah Bond operate.
Chickasaw Nation is south central Oklahoma. It is one of the largest of the nations. The five removed tribes that we normally hear about, the Choctaws, Chickasaws, Cherokees, Creeks, and Seminoles, generally, except for the Osage, have the largest nations in Oklahoma. And this one sits down, includes the Arbuckle Mountains, includes the Texas border, and lots of interesting wild territory down there. It comprises several Oklahoma counties. And within those counties, within the nation, there are pieces of the old tribal land, some still held by landowners whose families never sold it, and some that is owned by the tribe itself. And all that land is governed by the Chickasaw Nation government.
So tell us about Bill and Hannah and the legal world in which they operate as well. It's complicated.
It's very complicated. I went to talk to a few years ago to the chief of the Chickasaw Light Horse Police, and that's the tribal police in the Chickasaw Nation. And he talked to me for hours about the division of jurisdictions, and I had to take long notes. And he said, well, lots of officers have cheat sheets because the jurisdiction depends upon the race of the perp and the race of the victim and where the crime takes place. And this is complicated by the fact that sometimes there are little pieces of non-tribal land within tribal land. So very often you've got the federal government, the FBI, and you've got tribal police, and you have local police and the state police all working together on cases.
Wow. So the possibilities for, you know, action are endless for me.
Yeah.
So tell us about Bill Maytubby and Hannah Bond. They are such interesting characters. I love Hannah because she is so strong and self-sufficient, and she's just tough, and she's very appealing as a character. And Bill Maytubby is practically the ideal man in many ways, I think.
I've been criticized by some readers, including my editor sometimes, that he's too good.
He's pretty good. He really is.
My editor suggests ways in which I might make him a little naughtier.
Okay. I'll watch for that in the future. But you had to create a friendship in which there would be friction, but also understanding. You know what I mean? A complicated relationship.
Right. And even between Bond and Maytubby, that relationship, yes. They went to CLEAT together, which is the state training ground for commissioned police officers, and they graduated 1 and 2 in their classes. And I think Hannah was first, as I remember. And so they bonded, so to speak, in when they were in training together. And they ended up in jurisdictions that abut one another. So they worked together very often on practical terms, but they're very different people. He got a fancy education at St. John's in Santa Fe, and she's has very little formal education, but she's very smart. And so she ridicules sometimes his kind of granola ways, his health food and his exercise, and she thinks that's all a little bit put on.
His girlfriend is a dietitian.
Right.
That cracks me up.
Yeah, they get to do a lot of banter about that. I do know some nutritionists in the Chickasaw Nation. That's a very big job.
Mm-hmm.
In the nation, they travel around to schools and have education programs. So I drew a lot from my friendship with those nutritionists in my creation of Jill Milton.
Now, I have to say, it's obvious that you once wrote a book called Road Frames, The American Highway Narrative. I don't think that I have ever read a series with such precise directions. I mean, you know exactly where every car is, where they have to block the road, where the bridges are. I mean, even the titles are these locations.
The first book got a little bit of criticism because there's too much of that and too many highway numbers and things like that. I have read novels like Robert B. Parker's series in Boston.
Yeah.
And he talks a great deal about the streets and neighborhoods. And it doesn't seem to bother anybody there, but when I take them out to rural Oklahoma, it bothers some people. So this time in the second book in Greasy Bend, I toned it down a little bit.
But I think, do you go out and drive these routes?
I do.
I thought you must.
I've driven almost all of them, and I also have one of those gazetteer maps that, and I also have Google Maps, which I can, so I can look at things from satellite view after I've driven them, and I can find lots of strange things just off the road that I have to go investigate later.
Now, you're gradually revealing the backstories of these characters, and in Greasy Bend, the action starts when both of them lose friends to murder. And that's really a kind of brilliant setup for revealing who they are and how they act in the world.
I was very interested to find out all the things that I learned about them, because I conceived of the double murder of friends first, and then had to write the kind of backstory that was behind the murders and behind the friendships. And so I was very curious about those things. I did not preconceive of those backgrounds. They just kind of followed my characters to see where what would reveal itself. And it was very interesting to me, especially the Ta Lee playing, the stickball playing of Bill's friend.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go, my Chickasaw language teacher taught me the basics of stickball, and it's very, very hard. I don't even know how people do that, but it looks so graceful when you watch it. When you watch people do it, but when I tried to do it, I was a stumble bum.
So how's your language coming along then?
Oh, it's very rudimentary. It's only the very basic sorts of words and readings and things like that. So I do have the Chickasaw Nation. Has Rosetta Stone, and my language teacher is the star. He's the father of the family.
Oh, fantastic.
Rosetta Stone, yeah, I know.
Wow.
Great to see him in that role, but I like to watch that because it goes in very slow steps.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also have a great focus on the different social issues that plague the Chickasaw Nation. Talk a little bit about some of those.
For one thing, the best thing, we'll start from the good end, which is that they're prosperous. And the nation is building lots of clinics, dental clinics and medical clinics and hospitals. And there are satellites of them all over the Chickasaw Nation. And they also hire a great number of nutritionists and people in the field to go out to educate young children, not necessarily always Chickasaw children, just children in schools within the nation's boundaries, and about how to eat well and what sorts of things they should eat and not eat to prevent diabetes. And as with any kind of rural and relatively impoverished part of the country, there's a lot of drug problems. There's a lot of poverty problems.
And a lot of guns and casino gambling, of course.
Yes, casino gambling everywhere in the nation. Some of I think the second largest casino in the United States is in the Chickasaw Nation.
Mm.
So I think, although I have never seen the books and the nation, I don't think they readily reveal their income, but I have been told that gaming is the leading source of income. However, the nation has large industrial plants, you know, like for cast steel, and they bake those carts for the post office, you know, you roll around the mail in, and they also make those big plates that are on the luggage, the automated luggage carousels in the airports.
Wow.
They also make those. They make a lot of different things. So their income is their economy is diversified.
So what appeals to you about the police procedural? I mean, this is a very precise kind of writing that you have to do here.
Because it's orderly, as much as it can be, and I have to think it through like a chess game, and I have to ask a lot of questions because, A, I'm not indigenous, and B, I'm not a law enforcement. I don't have no law enforcement background. So I have to, there's question every time a police officer does a single thing. When they pull somebody over, when they take them out of the car, when they dust for fingerprints, every single thing that they do, I have to talk to somebody about because I don't know how it's done. So that appeals to me to learn those things.
Ah, oh, that's exciting. Well, I'm glad there are going to be more of these series, these two. They're so much fun to know. I love this setting. I really do. You feel like you can go and eat in these restaurants and drive these roads. It's amazing.
I like to go down there, and I like to learn the names of the plants, learn the names of the rocks, learn the names of the trees and the birds and all the animals. I know most of them because I grew up here, but I like that. I like because it's not an imagined world in the sense that, you know, I'm not going to get lost or I'm not going to have people in the wrong place if they're on a real physical map.
Right.
There's not going to be any logical problem with that because I know where they are at all times.
The road frame is clear.
Yes, the road frames are clear. Right. The coordinates are set. I would just say one thing. Some people, when I'm out on the book tour, they consider the Chickasaw Nation to be a reservation, which it's not.
Right.
There are tiny, tiny pieces of tribal land within the broad lines of the Chickasaw Nation, the jurisdiction of the Chickasaw Nation.
Books should come with maps and all kinds of things.
In Greasy Bend, the designer left a map out, and so when I got the advanced reader copy, I looked and I said, well, where's the map? Because there was a map in the first one. We'll have to go mapless on this one.
All right. We'll tough it out. We've been talking with Chris Lackey, whose new detective novel is Greasy Bend. You can meet him Tuesday, July 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Chris, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks. It's been fun.
Oh, great to catch up. Agnes Gomillion, remember that name. Agnes grew up in Florida, trained as a lawyer, and now lives in Atlanta with her husband and son. She's made an ambitious debut this summer with her first novel, The Record Keeper, with more to come, and that's what we're talking about today. Agnes Gomillion, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Now, these are great days for Afrofuturist fantasy and dystopian fiction. So, you've set your book after World War III. Now, what appealed to you about this genre and this temporal setting?
When I set out to write The Record Keeper, I was actually intending to write an antebellum book set in the American South. Afrofuturism and that genre didn't appeal to me because I didn't know what Afrofuturism was at the time. My character, Erica, when I started writing her story in the antebellum South, her fierceness, her beauty, her blackness just made it so the antebellum South was not a place where she could survive. Mm-hmm. Every time I started writing the story, she would end up, you know, in a situation where her back was against the wall, and it was more likely that she would die in the antebellum South. And so in order for her to complete her journey, in order for her to free her people and experience some of the things that I wanted to talk about in The Record Keeper, like black love and just the black girl winning, I had to create a world for her. And so without knowing what Afrofuturism was, without actually being a heavy reader in the science fiction genre, I created this world for Erica. I moved antebellum South to the future, which is why you see so many elements of the antebellum South in The Record Keeper. And once I moved it to the future, her book came out in 3 months. She was able to be her fierce self. She was able to grow into the full person, a whole human that I wanted her to be. She was able to be black and beautiful and bold and learn about love. And so once I had written her world and once her book was complete, I got more and more into the Afrofuturism genre. I learned what it was first. A friend of mine recommended an Afrofuturistic novel to me. And I read that novel and knew that I was trying to do the exact same thing. I was trying to be able to let readers experience and sort of live through the horrors of slavery, but then also tell the story in a way that they could experience the catharsis of freedom mm-hmm. all at the same time.
So tell us about the situation Erica finds herself in.
She finds herself a slave. She doesn't know it at the time. She is 17 years old, and she's taken from the plantation environment that she lives in and brought to the big house or the schoolhouse. And at the schoolhouse, they train her to become what's called a record keeper, a person that is privileged among her race. And Erica, at 7 years old, she sort of realizes her limitations in her world. She realizes how the law boxed her in, and she realizes her social place, that she's above the other people in her race, but she's below the English race to the north, and she's below the teachers that train her to be a record keeper. And so she finds herself in a situation where who she was born to be, this beautiful, wild, fierce person, it was beaten out of her as a very young child. So she finds herself in a situation where she has to assimilate or she will die. And she has to make that choice. Do I fight or do I die? And at a young age, she makes the choice to sort of give up her spirit. And the book really is about her learning to free herself from that situation.
Now, you said that this book is based on the life of Frederick Douglass, as well as a lot of your own experience in growing up and becoming aware.
When I initially set out to write the book, I was writing a book set in the antebellum South. I was writing a neo-slave narrative similar to Toni Morrison's Beloved. So I was going to fictionalize a slave narrative, and Frederick Douglass's book really helped me to wrap my mind around all that a slave narrative could be. So I started researching. I started reading every book I could get my hand on, every slave narrative I could get my hand on. And when I came across Frederick Douglass's narrative, the climax of that, his narrative, in the climax, he is working for a man named Covey, who was known in the South as a slave breaker.
Mm-hmm.
And a man so cruel that he could take a slave like Frederick Douglass and make him pliable and make him just a better servant. And in the first 6 months of working for Covey, Frederick Douglass was broken. He says of himself at the time that the light of freedom had left his eyes. He says that he no longer dreamed of freedom at all, and which is why he says that he doesn't know from where the spirit came, that when Covey came to beat him next, he turned and he just grabbed Covey by the throat, and he refused to be beaten. And looking back at that moment, in reflection of that moment in his narrative, the slave narrative of Frederick Douglass, Douglass says that that was the moment he became a free man. I was sitting on my couch when I read Douglass's analysis of that moment in his life, and I just was in tears because it said to me that there was much more to freedom than being physically free, and there was more to slavery than chains. Than physical chains. And I knew that that was sort of an idea that had been lost perhaps by so many through history. One of the tragedies of American slavery is that a lot of African-American narratives have been lost. We don't value them like we should. I never read the slave narrative of Frederick Douglass when I was in school. And so one of the things I wanted to do with The Record Keeper was mine those gems of wisdom and bring them to a modern audience so that young people, old people, anybody could benefit from them. And so the Record Keeper really is a retelling of that moment in Douglass's life where a boy becomes a man and a slave becomes free. And how do you make that transition from no longer being afraid to die?
But it's also a retelling of a moment in your life when you were in high school, when you were 17, and you came to a turning point and asked a really important question.
Very much is. I think what you're referring to is when I realized that I was, not that I was black, I knew I was, my skin was brown. Mm-hmm. I'd always been very proud of the color of my skin, but that what black meant in this world, that black in a way a box, it meant that you were supposed to talk like this. It meant that you could actually only achieve these certain things. There were lots of limits, not placed on me by who I was born to be, but placed on me by society, placed on me by the laws and the history of our country. And so I realized that when I was in high school, I was sitting in a class, we were discussing affirmative action. I was surrounded by my white peers. I grew up in upper middle class suburb of Orlando. And we were discussing affirmative action, and I was all for affirmative action. My father had gone to medical school and University of Florida on affirmative action scholarship. it was just so easy. It's an easy answer, yes, to me, but all of my peers were against it. Mm. My teacher was against it, and they were all arguing with me. And I realized in that moment that the differences that I'd always seen between my peers and I, curly hair, someone was a little overweight, someone else was a little more thin, someone else was a little taller or shorter, those differences meant very little when compared to the difference between white and black. And all of a sudden, I was black. I was different from everybody else around me. And so there's that moment. And then later on, the real crystallizing moment was when I read a book. So many beautiful things happen with literature. But
yes.
I was reading James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. And he was writing in his letter to his nephew an essay, one of the first essays in The Fire Next Time. I was jogging while listening to this essay. And he says, "Your job here, nephew," basically, I'm going to paraphrase it, "your job here is to not believe what they say about you, to not believe who they tell you are. You have been set in the ghetto, and you were intended to stay there. And so your main task here on earth is to remember that you come from a people who, in the teeth of the most terrifying odds, achieved a monumental dignity." And those words, I can repeat them because they stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about to cry now, but I started crying when I heard them because I realized then that no one had ever explained to me that before Martin Luther King, my people carried on through slavery. They carried on through Jim Crow. They carried on and with monumental dignity.
Mm.
So that moment was very beautiful for me. It made me realize that the way that not necessarily all the facts that I had heard, although I did hear erroneous facts growing up in my schooling, but the things that had been left out, the things that had been taken from my history, how my history and my knowledge of American history had been abridged, I realized suddenly that those pieces that were missing were parts of me that, if I could remember, I would be able to, you know, stand with pride and have, I don't know, have something to look back on with just such dignity.
And you began to ask yourself, I love this, what was I, a black girl, made of? And that's one of the most engrossing aspects of Erica's character. It's the urgency of her quest. That is the thing you share with her, that urgency, don't you think?
I absolutely do. You can see the fierceness in her. You can see the need to question, the need for truth, the constant digging for the roots of who she is and what's good on earth. And that's very much like me, yeah.
Mm. Now, one of the scenes that's so moving in this book is a scene where Erica is surrounded by the fallen. And she is trying so hard to do her best work as a record keeper and to capture the stories of these people before they fade away. And that seems to me to be almost the point of this book.
Wow, yes.
That every story matters. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do know exactly what you mean. And no one's ever identified that before. But yes, that is one of the points of the book. It's that urgency that you just talked about. I urgently want to mine the gems of African-American history. And I think it's not just me. I think that there's a role. The book is called The Record Keeper. And the reason it's called The Record Keeper is because Erica is intent upon keeping the record of her people, intent upon saving the history. And I think that this role has been repeated over and over again in African-American history. I remember reading while I was writing The Record Keeper how Alice Walker recovered Zora Neale Hurston's work. She was one of the first people to bring Zora Neale Hurston's work from the 1920s and 30s and bring it to a modern audience.
Right.
Look at this beauty. And then Zora Neale Hurston herself, she just posthumously came out with a book where she is retelling the story of a slave, one of the last living slaves. And so I think this oral tradition is really what it is.
Mm-hmm.
This taking the oral story and writing it down so that it can be saved for future people who need it, people like me who needed to hear James Baldwin say that. I think that's why it's called The Record Keeper.
Mm-hmm. So how far along are you with the next book? I have to ask now.
I am very far along with the next book. I am doing edits right now. Actually, I stopped doing edits to come chat with you. So it will be coming out June of next year, and I'm so excited to show readers the conclusion of Erica's story, show them how she deals with some of the anger, really, that comes with finally seeing what's been kept from you, finally seeing how mistreated people are. There's an anger that comes with that, and it's something that needs to be discussed. It needs something that needs to be felt. It's something that needs to be discussed. And so the next book is a discussion of what to do once you do wake up to what's really going on.
Oh, I can't wait. Will you publish on Juneteenth again? I think that should be your day.
They haven't given me a date yet. If they have, I don't. Maybe June. Yeah, somewhere around. I think it's about a year after. So, yeah.
Well, I can't wait. We've been talking with Agnes Gomillion, whose new book is The Record Keeper. You can meet her Sunday, July 14th at 2 at Octavia Books. Agnes, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Lee Ledbetter discusses and signs The Art of Place, Architecture and Interiors, Tuesday, July 9th at 6:30 at the Hubble Library in Algiers. Cecilia D'Artes brings her Jenny Giraffe character to the library for story time, Wednesday, July 10th at 11 a.m. at the Smith Branch Library. David Roll discusses and signs George Marshall, Defender of the Republic, Wednesday, July 10th at 6 at the National World War II Museum. Reception at 5, discussion at 6, signing at 7. Robert Azzarello discusses and signs 300 Years of Decadence, New Orleans Literature and the Transatlantic World, Thursday, July 11th at 6 at the Rosa Keller Library and Community Center. Sybil Morial discusses her memoir Witness to Change, From Jim Crow to Political Empowerment, Thursday, July 11th at 6 at the New Orleans Jazz Museum, 400 Esplanade. This is part of the Friends of the Cabildo Second Thursday Lecture Series. Author Cami Garcia and illustrator Gabriel Piccolo appear in conversation with Elise Arden to discuss their new graphic novel, Teen Titans, Raven, Thursday, July 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses The Bees by Laleen Paul, Saturday, July 13th at 10:30 a.m. at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Agnes Gomillion, discusses and signs The Record Keeper, Sunday, July 14th at 2 at Octavia Books. Jesse Morgan Owens discusses and signs Girl in Black and White, The Story of Mary Margaret Williams and the Abolition Movement, Sunday, July 14th at 2 at the Smith Branch of the New Orleans Public Library. Today's guest, Chris Lackey, discusses and signs Greasy Bend, Tuesday, July 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And in Covington, Kathy Crichton discusses her novel, The New Normal, Thursday, July 11th at 12:30 at the Council on Aging, St. Tammany Activity Center, 19404 10th Street in Covington. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.